Great, so welcome everybody. I'm glad you could brave the imminent cold and come out tonight to hear Ken Robison give a talk on the Civil War and African Americans in the Civil War on both sides. And the one thing I wanted to talk about that I'm so happy about is that Ken makes this US history. And I think that's really important too. It's good to have a month to honor and elevate and focus on certain kinds of contributions of Americans. But I think it's really, really important for all of us to just start remembering that everything that happens here is US history. And if we all want to be well educated, we should all know about it. So thank you.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
It's loud enough. Good. You know, it's one of those years. I'm delighted that we're able to get together, but what we weren't able to do this evening, and it's the first time in, I think this would be the 12th year we haven't been able to do it, is have our Black Heritage Evening in the Cordingley Room at the Gray Falls Public Library. We started that really with the group at the Union Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church. I'm an honorary trustee, and I, with a friend in Missoula, got it on the National Register back in 2003. One of the first things I did when I returned to Montana after my years in the Navy was take a look at what had been ignored in or neglected in Montana history and local history and Black history's Belle Claire. It was not only neglected, it had just been left out. So why write Black history? By the way, I should finish the Black Heritage Evening story. Kathy Reed and I, at this point, plan to have it the first Thursday in October, but we'll see. We're not totally fixed to that date, but we do want to have it, and then we'll have it again in 2022 in February, because there's nothing like gathering somewhere between 75 and 100 lots of African Americans, whites. I mean, it's a real racial mix. And a lot of kids come to that, and the three Black churches all support it. And we have good food and good stories. Last February, we were able to have it before things shut down. And we had Mayor Wilmot Collins from Helena, and that was a special treat to hear the story of this African immigrant make his way in Helena, Montana. So why write Black history? And I asked them that last year at the event. Well, that was the concern of Dr. Carter G. Woodson a century ago. He dedicated his life to educating Black youth, and of course it was the era of segregation. But he was concerned about Black youth knowing about achievements and contributions of themselves and their ancestors. He's the one that started the Black History Journal. He's the one that started Black History Week that grew to Black History Month. I think all of our goal is it shouldn't be a month. Shouldn't be a month for women's stories. It shouldn't be a month for African-American stories or Native stories. It ought to be year-round. And that's, frankly, what I do when I write a book. I embed ethnic stories of all kinds, and especially the ones I'll be talking about this evening are largely embedded in the first of my three books, Montana Territory and the Civil War. First of my three books that I did on another neglected subject, and that was Montanans in the Civil War. Had a few of them went back from here and fought in the war, but most of them came here after the war. Back to Carter Woodson, though, Carter G. Woodson. He said, those who have no record of what their forebears have accomplished lose the inspiration which comes from teaching of biography and history. He began life as the son of a sharecropper. In fact, he worked as a sharecropper for a few years before entering high school and going on to become the second ever African-American to graduate from Howard University, W.A.D. W.B. Du Bois is the first. Dr. Woodson was greatly concerned that young African Americans were not being taught about their own heritage and achievements, so he launched those things that I mentioned, and they've led to what is still being carried on today. He chose February because that was Lincoln's birthday, but it also was the birthday of Frederick Douglass, sort of indirectly because Frederick Douglass had no idea what his birthday was, so he selected 2 days after Lincoln's birthday, and the 14th of February became Frederick Douglass's birthday. But let's fast forward to Great Falls, Montana. When I started looking at what had been written, the Ferdells had done a book on Cascade County history, photo book largely, but they actually had embedded several African-American photos, related photos and stories in it, and that's great. But it was the only thing other than a really rare publication called Great Falls Yesterday that was put out by the WPA back in the late 1930s. And in that book, it's most unusual, but it had great biographies on about six African Americans. And they were there along with the other stories. It was the way history should be written. This evening, though, let's look at an aspect of African American history that relates to the Civil War. I don't think when I started work on the trilogy, what turned out to be a trilogy of Montanans and the Civil War, that even I understood how important the Civil War was to Montana. I mean, we were formed in the middle of the Civil War, 1864, in a hurried fashion because Lincoln wanted territories to come in loyal to the Union and so on. It became a refuge. The Upper Missouri region became a refuge for Southerners, especially those from the battered border states. Missouri, Tennessee, Kentucky, Arkansas had been trodden over, battled over for 4 years. And so many Southern-leaning families took refuge on the Upper Missouri. And so for the first 20-some years as a territory, we didn't become a state. And part of that reason was because there were largely Republican Congresses in the Washington, D.C., and there were largely Democratic legislatures in the territorial legislature. And it was the alliance between the Southerners and the Irish, both being very Democrat prone, that ruled Montana politics for those first couple decades. Finally, we became a state and so on. But that Civil War had that immense impact. I don't think any of us can quite comprehend. You didn't have to be a soldier to have had an immense impact on your life, your families, your farm, if you're a Southerner, your plantation. The Civil War had such a powerful impact. And it certainly had a powerful impact on the African Americans. Some had been in the North before the Civil War. Some, relatively small number, maybe one-tenth, had been free blacks in the South, but free blacks in the South weren't very free. They didn't have very many rights, and so on. So it really took the Civil War for the sea change to take place for them. But one soldier who did not come to Montana Territory after the Civil War was Colonel Robert Boole Shaw, and yet his name lives with us today. Colonel Shaw, the namesake for Fort Shaw, 30 miles west of here, commanded the 54th Massachusetts Infantry. That was the first black regiment raised in the North, and what it did, both in terms of being formed and then how they fought, became the model for some 200,000 African Americans that joined the Union Army that followed. As they raised the regiment, which had white officers like Colonel Robert Gouldshaw for this 54th Massachusetts, they first started in Philadelphia because they were coming up from their combat units in the South, Shaw and his deputy, Hollowell. And so they signed up volunteers along the way. And the first town that they signed volunteers was Philadelphia. Hollowell was the deputy, was the one that signed up the first eight, the first night. And the first guy in line was Alexander Branson. So in many ways, Alexander Branson was the first colored man to enlist in the 54th Massachusetts, the first black regiment raised in the North. Well, Alexander Branson lived through the desperate assault at Camp Wagner and fought with other battles and skirmishes until the end of the war. And then he came to Montana Territory and he settled in Lewistown. First he ranched and then later moved in as Lewistown as formed as a town. He moved into the town and opened a barber shop and became a very respected citizen in the community. Uncle Alex, they called him. He made it back to the 1902 National Convention of the Grand Army of the Republic. He was active in that veterans organization, the Grand Army of the Republic, and an officer in the Lewistown GAR. And for the rest of his life, he lived in Montana Territory until just a couple years as his health was failing. He took the train back to Pittsburgh to his closest relative, Anise, and passed back there. And he's buried back there. The second African American from the 54th Massachusetts that came to Montana Territory was Joseph Meek. Joseph and his brother Charles had been in Tennessee before the war. They'd been slaves. I haven't figured out how they were freed. Tennessee was never seceded, so the Emancipation Proclamation would not have applied. But on the other hand, the Union forces very often swept through the plantations, the southern plantations in Missouri and Tennessee and those states that were border states that didn't succeed and managed to free the slaves. So somehow Joseph and his brother Charles both were freed. Joseph enlisted in the 54th Massachusetts. Charles, on the other hand, didn't. He was younger. He was only 15 years old when the war started. He was able to make his way and somehow got in to spend his time not as a soldier at this point, but with actually Grant, before he went to the East, was in command in the West, and Grant had a substantial staff with him, and one of the staff officers actually taught Charles to read and write, and Grant offered to send Charles to college, but Charles didn't want to go to college. He wanted to join the Army, so after Grant went east with his staff, Charles lied about his age and joined a Kentucky cavalry outfit that was on some pretty wild battle action in the Kansas-Nebraska area. So the two Meeks, Joseph and Charles, both came up on steamboats to Fort Benton. Joseph started, well, they both initially started silver mining up around today's Monarch. There was a place called Barker, and silver mining was the big initial activity there. Joseph continued and had good success. He found a couple of loads. One of them he named after his wife. The other one was a very prosperous mining load that he kept working for many years. Eventually, he and his wife and child moved to White Sulphur Springs, and he's buried there today. But Charles didn't stay very long in the Little Belt Mountains mining. He moved on into Great Falls once Great Falls got going. Of course, we were such a Johnny Come Lately city compared to towns like Virginia City and Helena and so on. Sergeant Charles, this 15-year-old, by the end of the war, had managed to be promoted to sergeant. He was a natural leader. He built a house on the Lower South Side. All blacks were originally confined in Great Falls to the Lower South Side, meaning from basically First Avenue South to about 9th Street, 2nd to 9th, and 1st to, there was no 10th, but on South. Charles was very active in the meetings of the Grand Army of the Republic here. He was also very active in Republican Party politics. And you have to remember, in the decades after the Civil War, although it began to fade, Lincoln Republicanism was still quite active. And Lincoln Republicanism was more prone to grant full equality to blacks. Blacks voted in Montana, they attended schools, although the early legislatures in the early 1880s provided for segregated schools, if you can believe, in Montana. But that was kind of a token dumb effort on the part of the Southerners, because they couldn't afford schools, separate schools for the relatively small number of African American children, and Helena and Fort Benton were the only two that they tried to set up segregated schools. Well, Charles Meek, being active in Republican Party politics in the 1894 Republican Convention, and he was a delegate every year to that county convention, which named both city candidates and county candidates. He gave a very eloquent speech to the Republicans there and told them, in essence, you keep telling us if we vote Republican, we'll have equal rights, so it's about time one of us was allowed to run for public office. Of course, to this point, no black had ever been nominated, much less elected, in Montana to public office. But Charles Meek's persuasive argument led to the nomination of another young, relatively young black, William Morgan. He was a Civil War veteran as well, but he wasn't an Army veteran. He'd been in the Union Navy through the whole war. He'd been on the USS Sabine, which was a sailing warship, and they were in on the blockade of Confederate ports throughout the war. The Navy had actually been integrated, and in the Civil War it was about 16% black sailors, but it had been integrated since the War of 1812. I mean, integrated in the sense the crews were mixed race, where the armies were totally segregated. On the other hand, the Navy didn't have black officers. I mean, there was a limit to the equality. It was integrated, but not equal, I guess is maybe a good way to put it. But Charles Meek nominated William Morgan, and the Republican convention ratified his, or approved his nomination. And he ran for public office. There were two candidates for Great Falls Townsite Constable on each party's ticket. One white and one black on the Republican ticket against two white candidates on the Democrat ticket. And the Republican ticket won. So William Morgan who was also one of these Civil War veterans who was kind of a natural leader and was active in the Grand Army of the Republic, went overnight from being the janitor, which was a plum job, frankly, for the blacks in the Great Falls community. Janitor at the county courthouse was a political job. Overnight, he went from that to being the townside constable, and he served for a couple of years very successfully, and then retired to ranching outside Great Falls toward the Sun River Valley. The fourth one I wanted to talk a little bit about is not a Civil War soldier, but he was a soldier, and that's George Williams. George Williams joined the post-Civil War Army, the Frontier Army, and was assigned to the 25th Infantry. And in that post-Civil War period, there were four regiments that were black regiments in the Army. There were the 9th and 10th Cavalry and the 24th and 25th Infantry. So two infantry and two cavalry. They all served in Montana at one time or another. They also served in the Southwest and pretty much throughout the West. But the 25th Infantry was really the last of the four to come to Montana, and the only one of the four that was stationed at Fort Shaw. So in 1888, the 25th Infantry arrived to relieve a white infantry at Fort Shaw, and George Williams, Sergeant Williams, was one with them. They were then, in 1891, they were sent over to Missoula, and Fort Missoula was built up, and Fort Shaw was turned into the Indian Industrial School. It was turned over by the Army and the Indian Industrial School, that with the famed 1904 girls basketball team that went to the St. Louis World's Fair. Most people, I think of that when they think of the Indian school, but there were native kids from many, many tribes, including some from Alaska, that were brought down and attended Fort Shaw. So it became that Indian school after the military post was closed. George Williams, like the others, came into Great Falls after he'd retired from the 25th Infantry. And he, again, you know, I think I should preempt a question, because why are these things happening in Great Falls, Montana, when they weren't happening elsewhere in Montana? Although Helena did have a policeman early, and that was in the, I think, 1892, they did have a black on their police force. But George Williams was named to the Great Falls Police Force at a point where there were only four policemen in the whole town. Not only that, but he was assigned to patrol the Lily White North Side that was just being formed. You know, Fourth Avenue North was held in reserve, that whole North Side, until the town, the railroad had arrived, the industry was beginning to build up, and there were people of at least middle class, if not more substantial means, to buy the more expensive, larger houses that they were allowing to be built on the North Side. So George Williams was patrolling the North Side, and he actually lived there. He's the only black that was allowed to live out of the Lower South Side. I don't know exactly why that is, but the reason all this was happening, and it came to a halt and things changed, but it happened because for a period of almost 10 years after Great Falls was formed, the Lincoln Republican wing of the Republican Party that included Herbert Percy Rolfe and Will Hanks and a number of others controlled the city council, the county commission, and they appointed George Williams to be a policeman. Their party elected, got William Morgan elected. But by the mid-1890s, Rolfe had the Great Falls Leader, which was the Republican newspaper, and he died of typhoid fever at age 47, tragically. And with his death and the buildup of the labor unions that would not allow black membership, things began to change. And my talk this evening is not about that later era, but it'd be a good talk for another occasion. What I did want to continue on with a little bit this morning is, or this evening, is it, you know, we've talked about some Civil War stories. Robert Gould Shaw and two of his men coming to Montana, or he didn't come, but his name came, and two of his men living here with us. Now, if you've seen the movie Glory, and I think you understand how important that 54th Massachusetts Regiment was. If that had failed, if they had cut and run at Camp Wagner instead of charging into that hail, horrendous hail that made at least 50% of them casualties, if they'd cut and run, the North would have concluded that black soldiers wouldn't fight. 200,000 blacks probably would not have been recruited. The war would have drug on and on further. Immensely important. Election of the first African-American in Montana. There haven't been many since. I mean, Wilmot Collins, the first mayor, and of course, Geraldine Travis was the first legislator back in the late 70s or in the 1970s. So Civil War soldiers had a status, black or white, and I think their communities appreciated their service and treated them somewhat differently. But there's so many other stories, and I look at the story of Alma Smith Jacobs. Her mother had spent most of her teenage years in Liberia because her family had been part of a movement out of primarily Arkansas, but some other states, but they were from Arkansas, back to Liberia to remove themselves from the segregated South. Fortunately for Alma and us, Emma Smith came back as a teenager, got more education, and came to Montana, married a former soldier, and they settled in the Great Falls community, and Alma was raised here, and Alma went to high school here, and Alma was hired by the Great Falls Public Library. And I know most of you know how important Alma Smith Jacobs is to the Great Falls community, but others of you may not. And that's a tremendously important story, not just because she was African American, but what this woman achieved, both in terms of racial progress, but also in terms of being the first black state librarian, the first Northwest Library Association head, the first Montana Library Association head, and on the national board. She really made an impact, and in a very pretty quiet but determined fashion, she achieved. And then there's stories that, again, most of you probably have heard of, many of you probably know a lot about, and that's Leo Lamar and the Ozark Club. At the very time in the 1940s and 50s when blacks from the base or from the lower South Side couldn't enter a restaurant, at least not by the front door. Few of the restaurants downtown had let a black family, especially if they were with a white couple, enter the back door and sit in a back booth and be served, but that was pretty much an exception. So here was Leo Leo Lamar, who came from this incredibly broken home in Chicago by railroad to Great Falls, Montana, made a name for himself as a pound for pound, the toughest fighter in the area, and then opened the Ozark Club, which incredible jazz musicians and performers made a point of stopping at the Ozark Club as they ride the Great Northern across the northern part of the U.S. They'd spend a week or maybe several weeks. Young Red Fox, I mean, you name them, and the performers came, and they, and the beauty of the Ozark Club, that even during World War II, there are photos of this very small nightclub, but it was jam-packed, and it was jam-packed with blacks and whites and dancing, mixed-race couples dancing. Everyone was welcome at the Ozark Club. That was Leo's model at a time when everyone definitely wasn't welcome in a lot of the other restaurants and clubs around Montana. And there's so many other stories. I mean, here's a Great Falls High School kid, Wilbur Robinson. You've never heard of him, don't expect you to. I was very pleased to find his story, and I only knew part of it for quite a while. He didn't go all the way through Great Falls High School, although if you go to one of the roundups, the early roundups where they had actually had the kids writing stories in them, he's got a story in one, and that's really remarkable. That was probably about 1913. But young Wilbur left Great Falls High and went to Wilberforce to finish high school, and then he went to Howard University, the black university around D.C. And he received his doctor in medicine degree from Howard University, just as World War II or World War I was opening up. And I have, in the two books I've done on World War I, I've embedded stories. Here's Master Sergeant Horace Bivens, who is a Buffalo soldier par excellence, a magnificent story from the Billings area. Anyway, Wilbur, Dr. Robinson, enlisted in the Army, and they wouldn't allow him to be a doctor. He had to be a corpsman. But he served, and it's a fine story. There's a story also from a World War I black soldier from Great Falls, Leo Winburn. Leo went into the Army and was in combat, was gassed by the Germans. Many of the blacks were not allowed in combat. They unloaded the ships and did the grunt work, beans and bullets and all of the logistical and supply things. But Leo was in combat and his unit, and he was gassed, but he recovered. Came back to Great Falls, Montana, and started working in, probably at the time, the only job available was in the baggage department at the Great Northern, which was a darn good job for an African American in those days. And so many were either dining car waiters or porters with the Great Northern Railroad. It was amazing how many that lived here. Leo Lamar had actually been a dining car waiter on the Havre to Butte line until he really got the Ozark Club going. But Roy Winburn was such a personality and such a fine guy that over the years he rose to head the baggage department at the Great Northern. And so he had blacks and whites working for him. And that was really, really unusual. Testament to his ability. We could talk about Ed and Elizabeth Sims, the first black couple to come to Great Falls, Montana. Ed Sims, they'd both been slaves, freed by the Emancipation Proclamation, but Ed had worked on steamboats through much of the 1870s until 1876 when he got to Fort Benton And on that trip, and for some time before, he'd been so talented that he was they call him the purser or the clerk of the boat. And that sounds like a sort of a ho-hum job, but that job handled all of the freight, all of the passengers, all of the money. That was a responsible job directly under the captain of the boat, just like the pilot was directly under the captain. Well, Ed Sims was a clerk or a purser on the last boat the Red Cloud came up on. But he decided he liked the looks of Fort Benton and wanted to stay. And so after a few years around there, and then later working around the military post at Fort Shaw for the sutler there, when Great Falls opened up, he came in and then brought his wife, went back to St. Louis, married Elizabeth, and they became the first black couple. They led the black community until Elizabeth died before he did, but they both died, let's say, in the 19-teens. So for almost 30 years, they were the leaders and among the most respected residents of Great Falls, Montana. So they're great stories. And with that, I think I'll end and be glad to answer any questions if I can hear. Yes.
Ken, thank you very much. It's really interesting. I'm wondering, the people who came to the Ozark Club, what?
So the question is, where did the musicians at the Ozark Club or the performers stay? There's a hotel. The Ozark Club was burned in 1962, a month after Leo died of a heart attack. The Ozark Club burned under suspicious circumstances. But that was on, what was it? Let's see, like 116. It's, you know where the Great Falls drug, the five-story drug building is? And the building next to it is a Trinitas. Anyway, there's a lawyer. The law office has fixed up the old building that's just to the south of the five-story. And then there's a big gaping hole. Geiger's repair shop was on the corner, but the Ozark Club was right next to it. And it was a wood building, and it burned very quickly. If you followed half a block toward Central and made a right to Hoagland's, that's the building that was the Lamar Hotel. And the Lamars had a suite on the second floor, and they kept their entertainers there. And there was a block of the rooms in there that, rumor has it, is where B. Lamar had her Ladies of the Night operating from. But it was pretty much all done within that, what was called at that point Lamar Hotel. Name was later changed to the Vista Hotel, and today it's Hoagland's Western Wear. Any other?
Just so I have it straight. It's Lamar Hotel, but the owner of the Ozark Club was Leo Lamar. Different.
No.
Same.
Leo Lamar.
Say, so he owned the hotel as well?
Pardon?
It was his hotel as well? I'm trying to understand the relationship between the hotel.
Oh, they owned the hotel.
They did own the hotel.
Yeah.
Same.
And that's why they stayed there. They had their entertainers stay there. I might add, because we're talking ethnicity tonight, that until we started having nights at the Ozark, June 2007 was the first one, and Phil Auberg arranged the musicians, and Chris Morris was the head of the History Museum at that point. And I had the displays, and Linda Short, and I put the displays together, the stories and the photos. History Museum at that point had two photos related to African American history. I mean, it was just disgraceful. One of the two was those are burning down, and the other was an unidentified black couple. Well, because we were working on the Ozark Club, we had gotten in touch with the daughters. Leo never had any, well, he had a son, but he was killed in a car truck accident here. But his daughters had moved to Los Angeles after, along the way. And they still live in Los Angeles, although Sugar has now passed away, one of the three. But Sugar, Bunny, and Molly were living in Los Angeles. Molly was not in good health, but Sugar and Bunny and some of their kids and grandkids all came up for the first time to Great Falls, Montana since Leo's funeral in 1962. And they had shared something like 100 photos. And what you see over at the History Museum today in the room that's called the Ozark Room are my stories and the photos that the Lamars shared with us. I mean, it was just a gold mine because Joe Louis, the heavyweight champion, would join the Army, right? World War II, everybody joined the Army if they could. And he'd come on a trip to morale, you know, raise morale of the troops, black and white. They all loved boxing and world heavyweight champions. Joe Louis would be wined and dined and entertain the troops out in both Gore Hill and out of today's Malmstrom. And they'd have a lunch for him, but at night he was on his own and he couldn't go any place downtown except the Ozark Club. So Sugar Lamar would dance with Joe Louis. And there were pictures of Joe Louis with Leo Lamar and B. Lamar in the gambling room, which is a little room in the back of the Ozark Club. And another picture of Joe Louis standing by the Union Bethel AME church, where they took him the next day after, I guess it was must have been a Saturday when he was there at the club, and then Sunday he must have joined them at church. But the most ironic thing of all was, we haven't talked about the Chinese in Montana, and that's a whole different subject, but Great Falls totally excluded Chinese until Art Wong moved from Helena to Great Falls right before World War II and opened a Chinese restaurant, the House of Wong. Well, all of this time before then, this guy who was half Chinese was living in Great Falls and nobody knew it, because Leo Lamar had a black mother and a Chinese father. And Sugar and Bunny told us that, and we all thought that was pretty hilarious. If it had been known he was Chinese, he probably would have been run out of town. Instead of that, Leo Lamar had the kind of personality where he was playing golf with the mayor and the chief of police. And the night that Lionel Hampton's big band was passing through Great Falls on the way to Calvary, they had stopped early and talked a bit with Leo, but they had a gig up in Calgary, and so they had to make the border, and they failed to make it by, I think it was a midnight closing. So I think they probably got to Shelby and discovered they were not going to make the border. Anyway, they made it most of the way, but discovered they wouldn't make it in time. So they called Leo, and this was, you know, very close to midnight, and said, we're headed back. It's going to be after, now it wasn't that late, but it was late enough that they would get there after the, I think it was a midnight closing of the bars until like an 8 o'clock opening. There was some city rule about when bars could be open. So Leo called the chief of police at home. Chief of police had no problem, said, fine, as long as you lock the door after they come in. And I heard the story from June Elliott, who still lives here in Great Falls. Her mother, June was a teenager at the time, This was in the 50s, and her mother fixed the snacks in the Ozark Club, and was there that night, and June was there with her, and she put June off in a corner, and June spent the whole night listening to Lionel Hampton's big band. So lots of good stories. Any other? Yes.
Wasn't Howard University founded by a Union general who had a connection to Montana history?
Oh, you bet.
The one-armed general.
Oliver O. Howard, I think disparagingly, some who are not as fond of his military service as I am, called him O.O. Howard, and maybe worse. But anyway, General Howard was one of Grant's favorite generals. I mean, there were some. John Gibbon, who lived at Fort Shaw, Colonel Gibbon had the 7th Infantry at Fort Shaw and living in one of those two officer quarters that are still standing at Fort Shaw, the regimental commander's quarters. But General Howard, after the Civil War, became prominent in the Southwest in the Frontier Wars Army, and then up here in Montana, and he was maybe overall more responsible for the long, sad chase of the Nez Perce from western Montana all the way almost to the Canadian border. General Howard, very important to Montana history. And he had lost an arm in the Civil War, but managed to remain on active duty. A very fine general. And he actually had the impossible task at the end of the Civil War of heading what was called the Freedmen's Bureau. Congress had created this group called the Freedmen's Bureau to go in first to the occupied South as parts of, say, Mississippi were occupied, and receive the literally millions, anyway, hundreds of thousands in any one area of slaves who were absolutely destitute, had no food, had no jobs, had no schools, nothing. And the Freedmen's Bureau had that incredibly difficult task, first during the war, the latter part of the war, and then after the war, to set up the schools, to find homes, to treat these millions of newly freed African Americans. And General Howard headed the Freedmen's Bureau and started Howard University, is named after him. But that task is an incredible task. And I actually, in Montana Territory in the Civil War, found a young lady who had lived, she was a teacher in Illinois. She was recruited by the Freedmen's Bureau and went down to, quote, occupied by the Union, Mississippi. This was before the war was over. She and another teacher, both Freedmen's Bureau, she was writing home to to friends, and describing the nearly impossible situation, begging for clothing, anything that could be sent to help, because they were far more than teachers. They were sort of part-time welfare workers and so on. So this young lady's story is in my book, and I was fortunate because while I knew about her story, but then I found a series of letters that she'd written from occupied Mississippi describing the conditions and the threats of local Southerners to burn the house down if she and the other teacher weren't sent packing and so on. And I was at a book signing over at Fact and Fiction in Missoula when that book first came out. And this couple came up and she said, I'm a direct descendant of this teacher. And I had no idea about this. But what they did know about, she and her husband had the diary of this teacher's husband. She, after the war, married a Union officer, and then they came to the Bozeman area. He was a skillful engineer, and he worked on the irrigation systems and so on. But anyway, they settled there. And they had his diary, and I had her story, and they were just delighted to get together. Anyway, I've wandered on enough. Thank you very much.